Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, we've had from time to time on American Variety something that I sort of semi-laughingly call dog days, and this is going to be one of those. And really, it's not just dogs, but involving, pretty much domesticated animals in general. My guest is Dr. Nicholas Dodman, who's a faculty member at the Tufts University School of Veterinary Medicine. He's a veterinarian, and that's located in Massachusetts, somewhere west of Boston. Nick Dodman is one of the world's most noted veterinary behaviorists, right? So he founded the Animal Behavior Clinic at Tufts University there. Welcome, Nick.
Good to be here, Court.
Nice to have you on. He's a frequent guest on TV shows all over the cable roster, Discovery Channel and Nova and A&E, and lots of times on Animal Planet. And, you know, to me, Animal Planet, and in particular shows like Cesar Millan's The Dog Whisperer, which I guess is on some other channel, National Geographic or something, have greatly increased our interest in the behavior of domestic animals in recent years, especially dogs. And so I think it's, people are much more focused on what their dogs kind of think and feel, and there's a general feeling that they do think and feel, I think. So that's the field that Nick Dodman is in. How long have you been in the field, Nick?
Well, I've been a vet for 41 years, and essentially, round numbers, the first half of that career I was involved in anesthesia and surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I came to the United States 30 years ago, I was actually in that theme, but then I gradually morphed into behavior through an epic experiment that's completely absorbed me and my attention, and it was something to do with horses and something to do with behavior. And after that, I changed like a chameleon into a behaviorist.
Your behavior changed. So would you agree with what I said a while ago? Have you seen a ramp up in general public interest in the behavior of their pets in that
Absolutely.
Time?
You know, it wasn't that many scores of years ago, and still in some pockets in this country now, that dogs, for example, are regarded as, like, they have a utilitarian function, guard dogs or hunting dogs and such like. But much more generally, there's been an appreciation of them as thinking, feeling, living creatures that have been brought into the home and progressively being regarded more so as family members. People are spending money on their health care and on their food and looking after them. And, you know, at an extreme, one famous quote is that when asked to choose between their pet and their spouse, 70% of people would rather stay with their pet.
They're only answering that question when their spouse is not in the room, but I certainly do. My wife will probably be listening to this show, but I certainly do remember saying to her, kind of semi-tongue-in-cheek at one point, with a dog that we had that she really loved, I said, if Rudy and I were both strapped to adjoining rails of a railroad track and a train was coming, I would hate to see which one. You could only choose to save one. I'd hate to see which one it would be.
Well, as a matter of fact, that's the theme of a very good trainer, Victoria Stilwell, has a TV show, and it's called It's Me or the Dog.
Oh, really?
And, you know, in parentheses, that would be, one of us is going to get out of here pretty soon if you don't fix this problem. And that's the theme these days, and that's what I see, too, in my clinic. I see people here in desperation.
Mm.
In fact, I often call this clinic here at Tufts the last resort nation, because they've spent 2 years going around various trainers and doing everything they know, and then finally they give up and come to see me.
Yeah. So, you know, we can talk later about why that is, this really noticeable increase in the focus on pets, not as you say, as work animals or as beasts of burden before, but to companions and then really to family members. I mean, almost to like children. And, you know, it's just been an almost extreme movement in that direction. And there are plenty of big box stores that you can walk around in with your dogs, and even restaurants, and certainly hotels have become much more pet friendly. I mean, I think the Hilton chain is pretty much universally pet friendly, even with large dogs, which is surprising nowadays. But so on the science side of things, I remember reading once, 10 or 12 years or so ago, that animal scientists at that time thought that dogs do not smile or exhibit emotion. And as a longtime dog owner, I thought, you know, these people... You know, this is ridiculous. They must not actually live with dogs. They must just look at them in a lab situation or something where they're probably scared and don't smile. But it's pretty obvious to people who live with dogs that they exhibit all kinds of, or a whole range of emotions, really, almost like a human child, I think. So what emotions, that's the field you're in, right, as a behaviorist, and that's kind of the ground you've broken in really expanding that awareness that domesticated animals have a wide range of emotions. So what emotions do you think or know that dogs experience?
Well, they have the full range of so-called primary emotions. So, you know, yes, they get angry or aggressive, feel angry and are aggressive. Yes, they feel fear and such like. I mean, this is without a shadow of doubt that they have these issues.
Sure.
And in fact, there was a show on public television, Nova, I think, where it was called something about What Animals Think, and it was a three-part series, and they had very famous people from Marion Dawkins of Oxford University in England to Jane Goodall from sort of down south the United States these days, and all kinds of experiments showing, you know, for example, that if you show an animal a frightening sort of stimulus, that the same area of the brain, so-called amygdala, lights up, and the same chemicals are involved in everything. And really, it's without a shadow of doubt that they have primary emotions. The only argument has been about secondary emotions, things where they're kind of inferring that they have, for example, they call it sort of theory of mind, that is, I am me, and you over there have information that I don't have about something else. So they're sort of triangulating, and even that's being cracked now with Brian Hare's finger-pointing experiment implies that the dog knows that the person has some information that the dog doesn't have. So when they motion towards food under a bowl, the dog will go to that bowl rather than the other one. Experiments in England where they've looked at thousands of dogs and come to the conclusion that, yes, indeed, they experience jealousy, which is a secondary emotion. And, yes, indeed, they feel anxious and they do grieve. And there's all sorts of things that you... Well, a few years ago, you wouldn't have even been allowed to breathe that they showed. But at the same time, there are people who managed to devise laboratory-type experiments that sort of seem to show, for example, that dogs don't show guilt. But, you know, an experiment is as good as it's set up to be. And as you said, we've come a long way from the days of set-up experiments and sort of Skinnerian behaviorism through more the ethologists. And more recently, people like Jane Goodall, who, rather than just looking at chimps, lives amongst them. People who study birds, you know, not just looking at them from a hide, but actually being part of the flock, so to speak. And you know, people who have dogs and in that situation anyway, because they live with their pet and they understand what's going on better than a scientist looking at it remotely through a telescope.
Of course. And people aren't regular dog and pet owners aren't, let's say, hampered by the restriction of the responsibility to construct an experiment that's going to be reproducible by other scientists and that's going to be, you know, have ironclad proof and be shown in a clinical setting with a structured set of procedures to work all the time. They basically just observe it. I mean, every couple who has a dog that's attached to one of the couple more than the other, which usually is the case, has probably experienced the phenomenon of, you know, you're standing in the kitchen and you hug each other. The dog will come and jam its head between the two of you and shake its head from side to side trying to separate you because it's jealous of the one party or the other. Or if you have two dogs and you're petting one, the other will come and try to get in between. And, you know, that's clearly jealousy.
I had a very extreme example of that that ended tragically yesterday. And this was a Wheaton Terrier who came into the home and took a shine for the wife. Like, the dog and the wife were an entity, you know, they're best friends. The dog hated the man. So he got so aggressive towards this man in what I called unidirectional aggression that the man had to telephone ahead when he was coming home. So the dog was put away. And at one time in the yard, the dog was tethered and managed to pull the stake out of the ground and chase the man who was mowing the lawn and was only saved by his wife rugby tackling the mobile stake. But then a couple of days ago, what happened is the dog got out from his enclosure and actually did get to the man and savaged him. And he said the dog had the strength of 10 men. It was like a 45-pound Wheaton Terrier. And it was on top of him. Then he was on top of it. And he got very badly bitten up. I mean, he can't feel his hand and whatever. And eventually he managed to pin the dog for long enough that the police and emergency services arrived. And the wife gave a clear plastic muzzle to the emergency service. They pressed it onto the dog's face so he couldn't bite the man while the man got away and went for medical attention.
Unreal.
But they held it on too long and obstructed the holes and they suffocated the dog.
Oh, my gosh.
So that dog died of his protection or jealousy. I mean, he could be...
Yeah.
He was perfectly fine with the man as long as the woman wasn't around.
Yeah.
As soon as she came in the picture, he turned into Cujo.
Extreme jealousy. Well, that's an awful story. I mean, I can tell you a comparable story that's more funny than awful, but I had a friend one time, a woman whose parents had gotten divorced some years before, and then later the wife or the ex-wife or the woman got remarried, and they had not a standard poodle. I think it was a miniature poodle, and the poodle was a male, and he was very attached to the wife, and he did not like the sudden appearance of another man in the household. And after he sort of semi-tolerated him for a few days, the man had moved in and put his desk and his office in a den in the house. And he went up, and the dog had gotten up onto his chair and then onto his desk and had defecated right in the middle of his desk on his papers. I mean, you know, that's a pretty clear symbol of crap on you. Get out of here.
As they say, there's mud in your eye.
Yeah, right, something like that. Yeah,
yeah, so, that's called marking. Mm. And actually a lot of animals, including dogs, and I hate to mention it, but also certain humans, robbers and whatever, do fecal marking.
Hmm.
It's ubiquitous throughout the animal kingdom. I've got a friend veterinarian in California who studied urinary and fecal marking in all kinds of wild animals in Africa and beyond. And, you know, not to mark with urine and feces is actually more common.
Hmm.
So that's a very common, that's an indicator of extreme, you know, territorial anxiety and sort of claiming things back, as it were. It's like the mark of Zorro.
Yeah, but it wasn't just in his general vicinity. It was right on the middle of the thing that was clearly his own center of his possession.
Yeah.
You know,
he defecated in his general direction.
Well, it was more specific. Yeah, you're Monty Python, right?
Specific direction.
Yeah, right. But
no, and there was no mistake about that. And
yeah.
we have dogs that say the young woman has a man friend stay over, and then the next morning the dog comes, jumps into that side of the bed where the man was, and defecates right in sort of in the depression that he's made in the mattress.
Yeah,
I mean,
so,
it's pretty specific.
Yeah, so anyway, but I think other, you know, people have always observed grief, you know, when the dog's beloved owner passes on, the dog will just lie down and curl up and not move for days, you know, and that kind of thing. And so all of that's pretty clear, and, you know, and yet because scientists are kind of professionally forced to wear blinders, it was hidden to scientists until recently, and you came along and helped shed light on that whole thing. So why don't you describe the smile on a dog?
Well, there is a thing called a submissive smile, so that, you know, if a dog takes his lips and retracts them vertically to expose his teeth, that's aggressive. But if he takes his lips and retracts them horizontally, sort of widening the sort of aperture that is the mouth into a sort of a smile shape. That is called submissive grin, and often goes along with other sort of submissive postures. He's sort of exposing his teeth and pulling his lips sideways, and you say, well, that's not a smile. People smile when they're happy.
Mm.
But the thing is that actually a smile is a disarming human gesture.
Sure.
In the sense that when you smile, you know, you're actually showing deference. So if you see someone, it's almost like when you wave at somebody. They say that the reason we wave is that you're showing that your hand is open, you don't have a weapon.
Mm.
When you avert your eyes, you know, you're less threatening.
Mm.
When you retract your lips, you smile and expose your teeth in a friendly way, like it's disarming. And actually people who smile a lot are very successful because they're not threatening to other people. So it's really the same kind of thing. So our smile is just called a smile. Theirs is called a submissive smile. Ours is a disarming or submissive smile also.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we are just more highly evolved, although that could be debatable, but we're more highly evolved mammals. And, you know, so a lot of our basic expressions come from dominant submissive behavior and predator-prey reactions and all that stuff, the same as they do in dogs. We've just evolved them a little more and made them formalized into, you know, social requirements. Go ahead.
Yeah, especially primates. I mean, if you look at their gestures, you know, if they make a mistake, you give them some puzzles to do, they make a mistake, they slap their hand on their forehead.
Oh, really?
Oh, no, oh my God.
Oh, but
you know, it's exactly the same, and from the smile, from the happiness to everything, it's exactly the same, so, which is hardly surprising to a person like me, because I have a sort of biological view of the world and believe that we evolved, which is, you know, not universally accepted in the United States, much more so in the rest of the world. But, you know, we have something like over 95% the same DNA as a dog.
Mm.
We have a four-chambered heart. We have a brain with the same structures, the same neurochemistry, respond to the same medicine. You take something, for example, just anxiety in a dog or a cat. A, it looks like anxiety. B, it involves the same neurotransmitters. C, it responds to the same anti-anxiety medications. So I say if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck and looks like a duck, it probably is a duck.
I would say so. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. Nicholas Dodman, a veterinary behaviorist at Tufts University, who's one of the leading researchers in the world who is describing for science how animals feel and express emotions. So I've always seen, Nick, that of the dozen or so dogs we've owned, that some are noticeably smarter than others. One, I recall, was a very large miniature schnauzer, a male, that even the vet said he's unusually cerebral, and he would he clearly knew at least 20 words, maybe 25 words, and you could string them together into rudimentary sentences, without without a lot of prepositions and stuff, and he would understand what you meant, and he would go do a fairly complex behavior, not that he was well trained or obedient, but especially if it was attached to his getting what he wanted, like food or something, he would know exactly what you meant, and he would go there and do that. And other dogs are a little more obtuse, and but so do you notice that there's a big range of kind of intelligence and emotional intelligence among dogs in particular?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, just like people. I mean, some people may not be that super smart. I mean, they can be very nice, but not super smart. And that's why, with humans, the IQ, 100 IQ is average. So there's, by definition, half of them are less than 100 and half of them are more than 100. When you start looking at the great apes, I understand that great apes have an IQ. Some of the smarter great apes have an IQ of like 95. That's around, where some people are.
Sure, of course.
And dogs also seem to have this array of intelligences. And, my wife met a person out on the walk yesterday. He said, oh, my dog is a wonderful dog. He doesn't have much going on between the ears, however. And my wife said, well, actually, that's a little bit like our dog, Rusty, who is the most wonderful love bug, super friendly, wonderful dog you could ever imagine. But, he's not terribly cerebral. He will, chase things and bark at things and get weird things and not really a thinker, But others are kind of sharp. And there's dogs who have been shown to learn over 1,000 words of spoken language. I mean, there was an experiment that was showed, I think it was a border collie, learned over 200 words that was published. It was a German dog, I forget the name, Diesel or something. But this one more recently was over 1,000 words. I had a trainer tell me her dog, she had a dog that knew 850 to 900 words. And they know them in context, too. So for my dog, even the one who's not so incredibly smart, I mean, definitely knows. You can't say the word walk. So we went to W. Now he knows what W means. Now we're on to A. Let's take. Did you take him for an A today?
Yeah. We'll say you want to go. Do we need to take them OUT? Same kind of thing. So I mean, I think at the high end. Well, let me say that in my observation, just like you were saying a minute ago, that the smartest dogs tend to be less affectionate, and conversely, the ones who seem less cerebral tend to be more affectionate. And I don't know if there's a kind of a built-in natural inverse relationship there, and it may be somewhat true of humans too, right? The really super smart, whip smart people tend not to be lovey-dovey, and vice versa.
Well, I think that's true, and the term that's fallen into disrepute now in dogs for reasons that I understand but I don't think are super valid is dominance. But let's not use the word. Let's say a dog who is pretty much in charge of his life. He's a little bit obtuse, but he's not scared of much. He's just in charge of his little empire and what he's got. Those dogs tend to be more independent and solitary, and not aren't necessarily the best pets because they'll come to you when they need something, but they're pretty independent. But as you said, the needy dogs, the ones who are less independent, actually make the nicest pets. Although there are some issues that go along with being needy and a little bit on the anxious or sensitive side.
Yeah, they tend to be more high maintenance, but you get more from them in that sense, depending on what you want from them. Well, if dogs vary, and I guess it's kind of two separate tracks, really. Brains and emotions, feelings and intelligence are related, but kind of two different categories of characteristics you can talk about with animals. But if we're talking only about emotions, which is what you focus on a lot in your work, what mammals are the most emotional? We've been talking primarily about dogs and a little about primates, but can you kind of loosely rank them pretty quickly?
Well, obviously the marine mammals, you know, cetaceans, they're pretty smart. And, you know, when you take brain size and, you know, ability to recognize self and such like, you know, they're actually right up there in terms of smart. So I think it's, you know, human obviously tops the chart, especially when we're using our own IQ test.
Right.
But, you know, a dolphin, for example, is extremely good at being a dolphin and has a much more complicated life than we think. They don't just run around like Flipper and jump up and down and smile and flip their flippers together.
Sure.
They have a complicated social life. And you know, when you're living, you know, in a group like that, and dogs also with the pack, you have to have an understanding of what the other one's doing. You can't be running along doing your own isolated thing. You've got to have a sort of group mentality. They understand the group. There's other dolphins are welcome in the group and others aren't welcome. And sometimes they can get quite savage and other times they're you're really quite, seems almost altruistic in trying to save people or close relatives or whatever.
Sure.
So I think humans, cetaceans, primates, but yeah, not too far behind are other mammals, dogs, for example, cats, and so on. All the mammals you know, essentially have the same basic blueprint. It's the difference between us all is like the difference between a Commodore 64 and you know, the very latest Apple computer or some such.
Do you think that domestication has increased the emotional range of dogs and other pets? I mean, in other words, have we bred them to relate more to us, and over time they've become more emotional and maybe more intelligent?
Well, the party line at the moment is that, for example, well, if you take an animal like a horse or a cat, they haven't really been domesticated much, that the wild type is only like two generations back.
Hmm.
So, but a dog has been specifically domesticated for, you know, arguably thousands of years, and with the creation of breeds and desirable traits and breeding towards them. And it's considered that what's happened is what's sometimes called neoteny, that we bred them to be more like the juvenile versions of their ancestors, the wolves.
Yeah.
So wolf ancestors will, you know, bark and go around with submissive smiles on and you know, wriggle and squirm and deferent until they become adult and mature, and then they tend more to howl as communication, and they live this, you know, independent you know, group life, but they can be independent, so they're kind of like grown up. The dogs are like Peter Pans, they never kind of quite grow up, but it depends a bit on the breed.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the northern breeds are still, you know, a little bit further from this neoteny process, and some of the smaller, flatter-faced, you know, lap dog types, King Charles Spaniel, for example, they tend to be more on the neotenized side, and we've bred them for things that we like affection, but in the process we've lost things that were more doggy. Mm. Some would say we've lost pack mentality. I can't believe it's gone completely. But, I mean, especially when they still walk around in a circle to flatten the grass before they go to sleep at night.
Right. Or they look for a certain place to do their business and, you know, they're careful about leaving their spoor here and there and, you know, they're territorial and all that.
I mean, they haven't had to hunt for a long time. Domestic dogs have, you know, certainly since the advent of dog food and, you know, even going back 100 years with human table scraps, they haven't needed to hunt to stay alive, and yet the predatory instinct is alive and well today.
What about other vertebrates like, I don't know, fish or large lizards? Do they have any kind of emotional expression that you can tell, or have you looked at those?
I've read some stuff. I haven't done any primary work on that, but you know, I once went down to the Polaroid research headquarters on Land Boulevard in Boston, and they had a big bunch of really super-looking sort of goldfish, shabunkin-type creatures.
Hmm.
And these guys could see out. You know, you always think about them living in their little aquarium world. Well, it was a big aquarium. But they could see when people were coming. They'd get very excited and go to the glass. And it's actually been shown that fish are far more intelligent than we had formerly recognized, that, you know, they do, they're capable of pain, and they live in groups, and they know what's good for them, and can be trained, for example, to swim through a hoop in return for a reward, so they're trainable. And it makes it even more of a shame that when they're caught, they're just thrown on the deck and allowed to suffocate.
Yep.
And actually, the lizards, too, recently have been shown to be smarter than you'd think for something that, you know, basically looks like a gecko stuck on a wall. Doesn't look like it's having a lot of cerebral stuff going on, but they're actually smarter, too. I can't remember chapter and verse of what I read, but it was something that indicated that they have a level of intelligence that's so surprising to us.
They will turn and look at you, and if you flip on a light, and, you know, I once, when I was much younger, bought a townhouse in Washington, D.C. that was infested with small cockroaches, and so I knew some people who were in the Foreign Service, and in Africa had the common practice was to get geckos and put them in your house to keep the bugs out. So I thought, well, I'm going to go down to the pet store and get some geckos and release them, and darned if it didn't work. But these four geckos, when I would walk into a room and turn on the light and they were on the wall, they would freeze, and then they would slowly back down the wall behind a table. You know, and they were very aware of my presence. You know, they would turn and look at me, you know, so it was kind of odd to have something, you know, 4 inches long and, you know, half an inch wide, be aware of your presence across the room. It's sort of interesting.
Yeah, somebody who once worked with me bred geckos, and I was always totally surprised and somewhat shocked by the fact that as she bred them, people would order them from around the United States. She would put them in a cardboard box and mail them.
Mm-hmm.
And her reasoning was that they don't really care which way up they are. I mean, they can be upside down or sideways or the right way up. Nothing matters. But I still thought mailing them a live thing was kind of weird and a little odd.
Well, we have a minute or so left, Nick Dodman. Let me ask you a question. Do you think that dogs think that humans are dumb and thick-headed?
I think in some ways they do, because while we're always on about them and, you know, wow, they don't really understand the spoken word like we say it, they don't have the language, they don't chop words and such like, the fact is, we're really obtuse when it comes to reading body language. We're practically blind. We don't see things that they see because of their different vision. We don't hear things that they hear because of their super acute ultrasound hearing. We don't read body language. So in many ways, you know, if the dog set us an IQ test or some obstacle course, you know, we'd be tripping over in the dark. We wouldn't understand what we were seeing in front of us. And they'd say, you know, these humans really, they're really not that smart. Because we know we are smart.
Of course. Dr. Nicholas Dodman, D-O-D-M-A-N, has written a number of books on the subject of animal behavior. The first was The Dog Who Loved Too Much. I'll just read the titles quickly. They're all available. The Dog Who Loved Too Much, The Cat Who Cried for Help, Dogs Behaving Badly, If Only They Could Speak, and most recently, his most recent book, The Well-Adjusted Dog, and all of these are available on Amazon and the usual bookstore outlets. So go ahead and buy those books, and also he has a website, thepetdocs.com. Dr. Dodman and his wife, Linda Dodman, who's also a veterinarian at Tufts University, do seminars around the country, and you can go to thepetdocs.com and look under the tab Events and see some upcoming seminars, and also can buy DVDs of past events. And I think there may be a YouTube video or so on the site that you can view and get a little preview of what that's like. Dr. Nicholas Dodman, thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety. It's been very interesting.
Thanks for having me on, Court. It's been fun.
Thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.